This podcast is brought to you by DKP & Co. Chartered Accountants. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to At Home with FNR.
The dust has settled, but the excitement is as vibrant as ever as Australian football fans look optimistically towards the future. Hello and welcome to At Home with FNR, Australia's only daily football program in isolation. It's Athos Syrianos and Nick Devano this Wednesday afternoon. It's great to have your company. We'll take you right through to 1 p.m. and maybe a little bit over, as is the case here at FNR. As always, you can get involved at any time. SMS us on 0428 933 45 or comment below on the Facebook Live. Nick, Australian football has done something that it hasn't done for quite some time, and that's genuinely celebrate something. Not only was it a landmark decision giving Australia and New Zealand the World Cup, but we celebrated the hard work so many people put in to make this happen.
Yes, good afternoon, Athos. Good afternoon, everyone listening all around, not just the country, but all around the world. Yes, we are hosting a FIFA Women's World Cup, and how exciting is it? I think it's just great that we've actually got this. You know, there was so much disappointment 10 years ago, almost 11 years now, when the 2018-2022 World Cup bid failed, and failed miserably. There was a lot of lessons to be learned, and this time around, we've got something coming in 2023. It's going to be a festival of football down here and also across the pond. I'm really excited to see how it all comes about. You know, there's not going to be any rush to have stadiums. You know, the one stadium that's going to be rebuilt in Sydney, but, you know, most of the other stadiums are ready to go. Maybe some minor redevelopments, but they've got 3 years to get it right. And by that stage, you know, we'll be able to gather in groups of more than five people and be able to congregate on stadiums all around the country and also in New Zealand. And I think that's really exciting. And, you know, great work from everyone involved, from the FFA to the Football Federation New Zealand, to the Prime Ministers, to everyone that's been involved from day dot. I think it's a great opportunity to celebrate what has been a journey, and it all concludes in 3 years' time.
That image which sees James Johnson, Chris Nicu, all the Matildas, jumping up and down, okay, breaking social distancing. But that will go down in history, won't it, Nick, as one of the most iconic images and videos, because that reaction was priceless. Many of us, including, you know, myself, held our breaths when Gianni Infantino said the host nation when he used the singular word. But then once we heard Australia, the room erupted. It was 2 a.m. Eastern time when we heard the news. They kept us on our toes. They made sure there was plenty of drama with that 40-minute delay. But that image, and I think Anne Odong, who's done an incredible job, she took a photo and it went viral right around the world. I look forward to seeing that image plastered upon walls and on murals for years to come.
Well, you know, the famous shot of the Socceroos players running towards John Aloisi in 2005 is arguably the most celebrated and one of the most famous shots ever taken, not only in Australian football, but in Australian sport. I think this would definitely be another one that would be, as you said, plastered on murals and, you know, plastered on boards everywhere. I think it'd be good to see an artistic interpretation of it, you know, a nice billboard that goes up, starting to celebrate and get the excitement going in major cities, not just here in Australia, but in New Zealand as well. I reckon this is going to be really exciting. You know, over the next few years, we'll be able to you know, congregate in masses and get to games and everything else. And the people from coming from all around the world will have 32 nations instead of 24 that we had last year.
Yes.
And the really exciting part is, Athos, you know, it's going to be an exciting 6 months, really, what could be for Australian football. You know, we've got the 2022 Men's FIFA World Cup in December, which is obviously going to change to obviously accommodate for the weather in Qatar. Then we come back from that, and within months, we've got another World Cup. You know, not a one-year break. We're talking 6 months. And by the time the Men's World Cup is done and then we get ready to get started again for the Women's World Cup, you've got to carry that momentum through. So I think that's going to be really exciting. If the Socceroos make it to Qatar, good run, then you get on board the Matildas in 2023. And, you know, there's every chance the Matildas could win a World Cup in Australia. The team is definitely good enough. They're only going to improve. A lot of those players will be getting in head up because a lot of them are still so young. There's a lot of great young talent coming through. So let's hope that this could be a really fruitful time for Australian football from what has been probably for the past few years and especially the last few months, a really dour time, a really, you know, dull period for football here in this country. And the World Cup was almost like that. It was almost that beacon of light and light in the tunnel and hope for everyone. Now it's come to fruition and we can look forward to what's going to be a really, really fun run. And hopefully a bit of silverware at the end of it.
The road to Australia, New Zealand 2023 is officially underway. We know as much as Melbourne will host the quarterfinal, Brisbane and Auckland, the semis and the final in Sydney. Leave your comments below. Let us know your thoughts at home with FNR. Brisbane Roar fans, we will be chatting about your club and the news it's found itself in with James Coughlin from the Brisbane Football Review a little later on. But Nick, you made a very good point. This is a very good opportunity for Australia to come home with some silverware in 2023. Interestingly enough, the host nation has only won this tournament only once before, and that was the United States in 1999. And the host nation winning, it's quite rare across all competitions. In the Euros, I think it's only happened twice. In the Men's World Cup, it's only happened five times, with the last being France 1998. So all of a sudden, as exciting as this tournament is and will be, the pressure piles onto the Matildas dramatically to do very well.
Well, it's always the fact whenever in any sport, when you're the host country or you're a player from that country performing, playing in a tournament, the pressure is immense. You know, the last time that we had the Australian football tournament, he was the Asian Cup, and we all know what happened. You know, that was a great result, arguably the best result the Socceroos have had in any tournament. So that was, you know, that was amazing. And maybe, you know, lightning can strike twice. But, you know, as you say, when it comes to hosting events, you think of all sorts of sports. You think, you know, of, you know, tennis tournaments when an Aussie like Ash Barty or Nick Kyrgios is performing here. The weight of expectation is on them to perform and to perform. And it's very rare you see an Aussie win it. You know, you talk about golf PGA tours, you talk about rugby tournaments and all those intercontinental tournaments, continental tournaments where you are that beacon of hope for a nation. You're hosting it. So every game you play, it's your home deck. The pressure is arguably more on you than on the opponent. The opponent probably relishes that opportunity to come up against the beast, you know. And the thing about this is, you know, when we play these games in Sydney and in Melbourne and all over the place, I would love to see, you know, how it would work if by some chance, you know, New Zealand, they weren't too crash hot in 2019. But what if Australia played New Zealand? How would that go in terms of scheduling? You know, imagine like you got the two host nations collide in a match. Like it's almost like, you know, that would be the one time we see the true 50-50 split of the fans. I think it would be really awesome. I think that would be something to really look forward to.
Well, we saw it happen twice in the Cricket World Cup back in 2015. I think Australia played New Zealand in Christchurch and lost only just, and then Australia beat them in the final. So it's super exciting. We've got a big 3 years. We've got plenty of things to build. We have the Matildas facility in Victoria. And then, as we heard last week, the FFA are looking to create a home of football at St. George's old ground, which was where Johnny Warren started his football as well. We should also give a big congratulations to Ella Mastrantonio, who we love having on the program. She signed for Bristol City overnight in the Women's Super League. So she joins fellow Matilda Chloe Legazzo, a great pickup from their head coach, Tanya Oxtoby, who actually used to play in the W League. So she is using her knowledge of the scene down here to pick up some players for her own side as well. So great to hear Ella made the move over there.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It was great news to come through late last night that Ella had signed for Bristol City. You know, a good friend of the show here on At Home with FNR. We had her on about a month or so ago now. But she is a great player. You know, she's done wonderful things, not just here in the W League, but for the Matildas as well. You know, she's not the household name Matilda, like not even, you know, I don't believe she went to the Women's World Cup either, but no. You know, it goes to show the talent in the depth that the Matildas have, and more players going to Europe, the better. You know, Ali Carpenter going to Lyon. We've seen Sam Kerr make the move. We've seen, obviously with Alex Chino playing for Atletico Madrid and so many more. It's good to see so many more players start to test their luck overseas. And hopefully, as time goes on, we start to see potentially most Matildas playing in overseas competitions. I do know that, it does dilute the quality of the W League. There needs to be ambition to play in the best leagues, something that we haven't seen enough of with the Socceroos, definitely. So the Matildas can, I guess, be those players that are definitely testing themselves to the highest level. I reckon that'd be, it's a good future, especially as we said, heading into 2023.
Well, there's certainly a side, not just football fans, but all Australians can get behind them. We do look forward to a massive 3 years ahead. We also have an Olympic Games to look forward to. So plenty of opportunity to see Australia's best coming together. Nick, we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll check in with James Coghlan and chat about the Brisbane Roar and look in to this revised A-League fixture and what it could mean for the Victorian sides as well, who will have to go into a hub. Stick around at home with FNR coming back very soon.
You're listening to At Home with FNR.
Streaming football right across Australia and right across the world. This is At Home with FNR. It's Athos Syrianos and Nick Debano taking you right through to 1 p.m. Keep sending through your messages on 0428 933 45 or comment below over on the Facebook Live. Now, it's been a massive week, not only for Brisbane Roar, but for the entire state of Queensland. And whenever we want to break down some of the biggest stories from over there, we head to James Coghlan from the Brisbane Football Review. How are you, James?
Hey, guys. Well, it's been a pretty big few days so far up here with the news about Robbie Fowler and the Roar's fixtures, which I'm actually just going through now, trying to work out that I'll actually be able to get to the Adelaide United game. So that's good.
Fantastic. Great to hear. Well, it is great. Queensland has crowds in the AFL, and it's only right that the crowds come for the A-League as well. But you won't have any Victorians coming in anytime soon, and nor will you have Robbie Fowler returning as well, as you mentioned. What were your thoughts when you heard the news that he wasn't coming back?
Look, I wasn't surprised, mostly because I feel like when he went back to the UK for the start of the pandemic, I think he, or more likely his agent, was basically putting out his resume to anyone who was willing to take him back in the UK. I'm not all that surprised because also I knew that this Brisbane Roar job was only ever going to be a stepping stone for him because he's been trying to get a job in the UK for, I think, since his playing days ended, basically. Mm-hmm. So for him to go back, I'm not surprised, but it feels like he's left a project very much incomplete here because he'd done some good stuff with the Roar as well.
James, just a quick one about, I just saw about Robbie Fowler's tenure. You say he's done some good stuff, but I guess how would you rate it overall, you know, because there's been a lot of criticism, but there's been some, you know, some people saying some good stuff, you know, what are your thoughts overall?
I feel like it's so many different areas to judge on. Like from a pure footballing perspective, okay, yeah, it might not have been the, you know, Raw Salona stuff that we saw from Ange Postecoglou, but considering the state that the club was in when he came in there, I think it was 71 goals in the season before for the A-League, he fixed up the biggest problem, which was the back line. Like Tom Aldred was a fantastic pickup. Macaulay Gillespie, I think, has been probably the most improved player in the Raw squad. But there was all this other stuff going on as well, which I found it really hard to like him from the outset. And I think that was probably because, you know, from his playing days, he never really had to work to win over a fan base. He was able to just say, I'm Robbie Fowler. And he had such a big following from there. Whereas here, it was a fairly jaded fan base, obviously, over the last 5 years. There's been some ups, there's been a lot of downs. And I think they just never fully embraced him. And I think that probably was a bit of a shock to him.
Well, you mentioned the significant amount of goals conceded last season. So that was 71 after 27 matches. And 12 months later, after 20 games, Robbie Fowler's side only conceded 24, which is actually the third fewest in the league. So he's done an incredible job from a defensive point of view. He got the club to third or fourth at the moment. They will make finals. How do you feel this next part of the season going for Brisbane under the two interim bosses?
Well, Darren Davies at least has the experience of filling in after John Aloisi's departure last year as well. And I rate Warren Moon unbelievably highly. Like he's been a fantastic NPL coach with Lions. I remember him even strapping on the boots in a couple of FFA Cup preliminary games in his time with Lions as well. But and obviously he was a foundation player for the Roar as well. So I think he's got that tactical nous to really keep this side going. And based on some of the comments that we've heard from Raw CEO Dave Puray in the last few days as well, I think the overall tagline down at Logan at the moment is going to basically be, we're still in this. It's not just the coach, it's the whole squad. And I think they're going to try and use that as a bit of a rallying cry, capitalizing on that siege mentality that Fowler tried to create from the outset.
Exactly right. And I think obviously there's been a lot of talk about not scoring enough goals, and there's been a discussion at the end of the day. I guess this is a results-driven business, and if you're getting wins on the board, I guess that's what is the main thing at the end of the day. But going forward with Darren Davies and Warren Moon into next season potentially, do you think that Warren Moon has, we've seen Davies has a small sample size of games, but do you think Warren Moon in particular could take this team beyond this year? If, like, say, for instance, they get through, win three or four of the next few games, deep finals run, how do you see it?
I feel like of the two interim bosses, Moon is probably the one that would be in line to get the full-time job if they decide to go that way. Right now, he's the academy general manager, and, every time we see him, he's got a massive smile on his face, and the Raw do have quite a deep academy system as well, since they launched that in January 2018, I want to say. But overall, I feel like they are going to go local. Like that's another thing that's come out from both Chris Fong and Dave Perret in the last couple of days, where they want to come back and get an Australian coach as well, try and focus on that local development. And I'd say Moon would be a good option. He was one of the guys that we thought was very much in with a shot just over 12 months ago. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Moon basically treats this as a job audition.
It's an incredibly difficult situation to process, because it's very rare that we see an interim manager or interim managers come in and they have, such high, not high expectations, but there's so much still to play for. Normally, say, like in Melbourne Victory's case, they're just looking to just get through the rest of the season. But Warren Moon and Darren Davies can really achieve something come finals time. We're speaking to Ben Coghlan from the Brisbane Football Review, who's well abreast of all things Brisbane Roar and NPL Queensland. James, for those of us who perhaps aren't too familiar with NPL Queensland or Warren Moon's work, what kind of a manager is he? Can we see more of an attacking style of play? What can we expect from Warren Moon's team?
He's got a side that loves to play for him. Like when he was at Lions, those players were, always up for a game and, always really ready to go after, their opponent, the referee or whatever. They were very aggressive. And like he was able to get the best out of some of the most talented players in NPL Queensland. And I think the big thing about Lions as well is the fact that they were always able to take care of business. Like they won back-to-back premierships in 2018 and 2019. They won the grand final in, watch is just going off. Forgot to put that on. My big opinion of Warren Moon though is like, he won back-to-back premierships. He got the side to a grand final where they beat Olympic and they came oh so close last year. They made back-to-back NPL finals. He knows how to manage these really top-line players.
And in terms of the squad going forward, there's a core of UK players that he brought in his own accord. A lot of guys, like you said, Gillespie, Tom Aldred, et cetera, obviously bringing those guys in. Can you see a lot of these guys looking to stick around beyond this season, like considering they were Robbie Fowler signings, or can you see maybe a bit of a changing in the guards, some new guys moving on, and maybe some of those guys that we didn't see much of this season? Dylan Wenzel-Halls has been the one that has been on the lips of a lot of Raw fans, but can you see a lot of those guys potentially moving on, some new players coming in?
With the UK players, I think a lot of them actually signed for two-year deals, which was the length of the contract that Fowler signed himself as well. So I think, again, this is what's the most frustrating part of this is I think we saw the first stage of Fowler's rebuilding plan and that's all. We were starting to see them really gel, especially going forward. They had that Wanderers game just before they ended where they really started to flash in attack. But I think what you're going to see is like some of the guys like Aldred, Gillespie, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they stick around. But some of the other guys who have done okay but haven't quite gelled yet, Aaron Amati-Holloway is probably the most obvious of the imports there, where I wouldn't be surprised to see him move along, which is also a good thing for me because I don't want to stand next to someone that big and muscular just for my ego. As for Dylan Wenzel-Halls, he was another player who was very much a project. I think he was he's got all the skills and everything, but my biggest criticism of him was the fact that everything he did was at 100 miles an hour. He's still trying to learn the mental side of the game, learning that nuance of when to take his foot off the pedal. But he's such a good prospect that I think they'd be, you know, foolish not to find a way to get him involved, even if it is as a super sub behind Mirza Muradovic, who emerged like so much this season under Fowler.
Yeah, they've got some exciting talent at Brisbane, and they've got a great NPL competition there with so many players like Wenzel Halls, who are very much capable of making that next step. James, you mentioned the sort of the siege mentality that was created at Brisbane this season, a very much of an us against them type of thing. Well, that's how it certainly felt from an external point of view. We saw Robbie Fowler, David Perret, a lot of the higher-ups at Brisbane, very vocal on social media as well. Upon reflection, how does this bode with Brisbane fans? Was it the right way to go about things, or if they had their time again, would they perhaps do it a bit differently?
I think going with the fans at social media, that's been going on all season as well. I remember there was an incident which didn't get a whole lot of airplay where Fowler and Grant were going after someone in early February for calling them boring. And if Fowler is going to go back to the UK, I feel like he might have to develop a slightly thicker skin, considering, you know, a few people on Twitter saying, you know, play the youth, which is the, I've got my own opinions on how much youth you actually need to play in a squad in a results-driven industry. But yeah, I think that's something that probably got a little bit out of hand as well. But it does show the, you know, role that Fowler had in the role, where he was essentially their marquee signing. So everything was being done to try and keep him on board. And it's probably something that, yeah, you're right, I think they probably would have preferred to have dealt with it a little bit differently. Now, as I was just saying before, like, there was the incident with the rider from the Ladies League as well, where I think that definitely did cross a line as well. But I think it was a case of, you know, all season getting, you know, for lack of a better phrase, you know, harangued for the Brexit ball stuff, which, you know, isn't for everyone, but it was effective. It can probably go a little bit overboard in the social media age.
Exactly. And look, you know, I think if he was to go to England, you talk about tougher skin, the fans there are less forgiving. So, you know, the thing is, it doesn't matter how much of a god status he has in England. I think, but if he was to move on and go to a championship or a League One team, he doesn't get results and everything else starts firing up, you know, might not sit as well with them. But talking going forwards now, four games left, heading into finals, Brisbane a red hot crack for at least, potentially a deep finals run. Can you see Brisbane doing an unthinkable? Because everyone is talking about Sydney as being, you know, the team that everyone needs to, that they're the benchmark, they're the best. Could Brisbane do the unthinkable this season, or is, you know, too much change with the coaching turnover and, you know, and everything else? Or can they do what no one else thought was possible?
Well, before the season hit pause, myself, Scott and Adam from the Brisbane Football Review, we all thought that, you know, the Roar were a pretty good chance to at least make the grand final. And then, as we've seen with the Roar and grand finals, anything's possible, even after the 90th minute. But I feel like now there's just that little bit too much disruption, and I just think that, yeah, the players maybe now are going to be a little bit distracted and probably just thinking more, let's just get this season done and get on to 2020-21.
Well, we do look forward to seeing the Roar back in action. It is very soon. The season kicks off July 16, and then we have a massive 27 games in 28 days. The grand final, August 23rd, it's a Sunday. Be sure to lock it in. James, before we let you go, are you able to give us a bit of an update on the Brisbane Football Review, where you guys are at? Are you still broadcasting? And if so, where can everyone check you out?
Okay, so Brisbane Football Review podcast is on Wooshka, iTunes, Spotify, and of course, Football Nation Radio. We did an emergency podcast Monday night when that happened, and we'll be back with our season relaunch recap. We're still working on the title for that. That'll be out the week that the A-League resumes as well, and look forward to hearing it all on Football Nation Radio.
Fantastic. Very much looking forward to it. We'll also promote the show, so stay tuned to our socials and be sure to check out the Brisbane Football Review as well. James Coughlin, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be sure to check in with you again in the near future, and fingers crossed we can see the Roar continuing to do what they do best.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure as always. I will just go on record. My prediction for the Roar's full-time manager, Ben Kahn from Olympic FC, and my left field out there Hail Mary suggestion, Harry Kuehl.
There you go. So wow. If you are a betting person, Ben Kahn is well and truly up there. Him and Warren Moon have
responsibly, of course.
You know, of course. Him and Warren Moon have dominated NPL Queensland, so I'm sure they'll be well within the running to take that top job. Thank you very much, James, for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
James Coughlin from the Brisbane Football Review joining us here at home with FNR. Nick, some incredible stats that we mentioned earlier. Last season, Brisbane conceded 71 goals, and now they've only conceded 24. There are 7 games left to play, but it's an incredible turnaround, defensively speaking.
It is, and I think I didn't really realise how astute like the stats were for Brisbane because, you know, last year they were conceding goals like either 4, the 5, especially towards the end of last year. They were just open at the back. But, you know, I will go on record saying that, you know, I haven't watched much for Brisbane. I don't tune in to watch Brisbane often because they weren't an exciting team, but they're getting results. Like at the end of the day, what we saw towards the end of it, they were just getting the job done. And in a results-driven business, you've got to get the job done. Doesn't matter how boring you play. We've seen it happen in the big leagues around the world with guys like Jose Mourinho and all those guys that, you know, just want to get the job done. Robbie Fowler did that. But now it'll be interesting to see how the squad responds in the wake of him deciding to leave. Whether Darren Davies and Warren Moon can get this team together, because you've got to remember this Darren Davies Brisbane Roar is very different to the Darren Davies Brisbane Roar he took over last year when John Aloisi left. There's been a huge squad turnover since. Look, Brandon Ibbin, up front with guys like Mirza Maradovic and those sort of talented players, Scott McDonald as well, there's enough talent there to get him over the line attacking wise, and defensively they've got the defense to hold still. Whether they stick to that, you know, rigid defensive lineup and just want to come away with 1-0 wins is a whole other question. They've got Adelaide, Melbourne, Victoria, Wellington and Sydney in their next 4. They're not all easy games. 3 of them very well, I'd say probably 2 of them are extremely difficult. The other 2 extremely winnable. So I think that if they're able to come away with the wins, at least you'd think, you know, 10 points for a possible 12 would be amazing. If they can get 6, you're probably locking in. Maybe, I don't know what's going to happen with finals if they're all going to be based in Sydney. But if they can get a home final in Brisbane, and bring it back home, that would be huge, especially if they can have some more fans then by that stage. And even if it's only 10,000, they're only really playing in front of 10,000 people anyway on most weeks because that stadium is a bit of a cauldron. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, Brisbane are in a good position to, you know, maybe make the second weekend of the finals just based off their defensive style and the form of the and the unpredictability of that front line.
Well, we know the finals will be taking place this season. The FFA and the A-League have both said that the dates for the finals haven't changed as of yet, but we do know this is a very fluid situation. We did put a post out yesterday asking Brisbane Roar fans for their opinions on the whole situation. Ellen says that if COVID had not interrupted the season, who knows, Fowler's win-loss ratio was pretty good. Billy reckons you could tell Robbie Fowler was building a squad that could be very competitive in the A-League. And he's finished it off saying it's a big loss. So keep letting us know your thoughts on Robbie Fowler's departure from the A-League. COVID-19, it's been crazy. It is unfortunate to see, though. But we will get a season back up and running July 16. Now, what this does mean is, as of recording, Melbourne Victory, Western United and Melbourne City will at least get to play one game in Melbourne, or in Western United's case, the Lucky Buggers will get to play 2 games in Melbourne before they will head off to the New South Wales hub, where, as things stand, they will be there for the remaining of the season because all games scheduled for August in Melbourne now have penciled bookings in New South Wales. So it could be the last time we could see all 3 Victorian sides be playing at AAMI Park.
It's a really sad situation what's happened here in Victoria over the past 2 weeks or so with the rising COVID cases. You know, you get the sense of how it's that these clubs are going to have to hub. You know, if the AFL are already moving along and, you know, the A-League's only got 6 games to go, you think that these clubs just got to get ready to stick it up and go a month over to New South Wales if they have to, you know. Unfortunately, it's how it is. You know, if we were looking good to get back to a situation where it would be very similar to some of the other states and be able to play in front of maybe 25% of fans, you know, have teams flying in and flying out as what had been rooted and what some AFL clubs had already started. You know, we'd seen Sydney come here and play at Marvel Stadium. We'd seen, you know, the plan for other Queensland, South Australian teams and everywhere else to come and play here. But they want to get the season done. They need to get the season done. And there isn't, the beauty of it is there really isn't much time. There isn't many games left. You know, the most that one team is going to have to play six games, and then there's finals. And finals is a sprint. You know, there's three rounds of finals. I really hope that, you know, that it'd be very disappointing. I think you'd be looking at the table now after Melbourne City, they're probably the team to be kicking themselves the most because they're in a position to have the week off and would have loved to have had a home final in Melbourne, especially on their home deck. Unfortunately now, there's not much they can do about it. It's going to be even more historic if they're able to fly out of the woodwork and get the job done. And on top of that as well, you feel for Wellington. You know, they're the hard luck story out of all of it. They've had a great season, but they've got to come to the other side of not just playing in New Zealand, but they're going to play in a whole other country for the next 6 weeks or however long it's going to be. So at the end of the day, though, survival of the fittest, get the season done, move on to next year. You know, this feels like this season really has gone on forever. So for me personally, I just want to hit that reset button.
Well, the Wellington Phoenix are a side that have continued to defy expectations and defy the odds for the last two seasons at least. So I'm quite optimistic about their chances, but some local Victorian sides will really suffer as a result of these new restrictions. Teams like St Albans, Green Gully, Calder United, Brunswick City, Pasco Vale, Moreland City and the North Sunshine Eagles are some of the clubs in those northwestern suburbs of Melbourne, which are currently out of bounds, for more or less a better term. The clubs in the areas with the restrictions being placed on. So feeling for everyone out there and hoping that it can all be resolved very soon. But this does, for the time being, put NPL and community football in Victoria under a huge cloud of doubt, given that the Northwest has so many teams, so many big clubs as well. So hoping that everyone there is staying safe and well and that we can hope to get the season back up and running very soon. Now, Nick, we will be watching a large chunk of the season, if not the rest of it, on TV. We are hearing word that there might be some crowds in New South Wales during this hub period that they might let in.
Which is good, which is very good. Very good. For TV spectacle, very good. Very important.
Not sure how many fans they'll be letting in, but there will be fans nonetheless. But we will be watching football on TV, and we know it's not quite the same as being there, but I want to have a chat about some of the best experiences we've had watching football on the TV, whether it's been watching World Cups, Asia Cups, games in Europe. Tell us about some of the best experiences you've had watching football from the flat screen.
Have a drink, mate. Have some water. All right.
Choked, yes.
I think, yeah, that's actually a really good question, because a lot of the games that I watch are at unholy hours of the day. And, you know, for when we support our European-based squads, our World Cups or Euros or Asian Cups, we have to be, usually when you're at home, you're told by your parents, keep it down. So usually most of the time, that's the big overriding thing. But I think some of the best experiences, if I had a few, when I was really young, I watched the 2006 World Cup from America. So all the games were I was in Orlando and in Vegas. A lot of the games were at, you know, midday. So you'd be getting
fantastic.
You'd be able to go to the pool, like the pool, and they'd have the pool bars. Now, being obviously 8 years old, I couldn't go into the bar, but actually there was like some places where you could sort of stand on the edge and you could watch with a packed bar. And, you know, Italy would be playing, or at that time, obviously being in San Diego at some point, so Mexico playing, it was absolute pandemonium, just hectic stuff. But the US were playing as well. It was massive. So some of those experiences, I watched a couple Italy games at Wigan Street, 2016 Euros. I saw them their unfortunate loss against Germany at Brunetti's. That was amazing, that atmosphere for 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning, where a lot of the people were hobbling in from clubs. You know, I came straight from an 18th birthday and hobbled in. I think I took a half an hour power nap and was straight there. The next day was a complete write-off, but it was a great memory because, you know, that whole thing about, even if you're not there at the game, being around other fans, whether you got 50 or 60 people in a cafe, a bar, anything else. And probably most recently for me was the World Cups. You know, we watched the Australia-Denmark game together. And what bar was it again?
It was the Turf Bar on Queen Street.
Yeah, and the atmosphere was amazing for that game. And, you know, the Australia-France game was a similar thing. I went to a bar to watch that one too. So I think if you're going to talk about great TV experiences for me, they would have to be up there.
I find it so much different watching a game by yourself on the screen and then in a group. I remember when I was much younger, getting up for, you know, World Cup games. I've got the Netherlands-Uruguay World Cup semi-final here from 2010. I thought that was a cracking game, and I would have been 11, 12 years old. And, you know, you get up for all the games and you see Diego Forlan smash the Jibalani right into the back of the net. Yeah. There is a certain charm about getting up at 4 a.m. to watch the games, even though you're a bit dreary-eyed. The excitement is there, and you don't anticipate how bright the TV is, and you're fighting off the sleep, and then you see an amazing goal, and all of a sudden you're up and you're awake. So even though we have to watch the games on TV, there can certainly be a lot of fun to be had. For example, if your team's losing, you can just turn it off and go to bed.
Yeah,
and
that's right, that. You're right.
You can be as loud or as quiet as you want. You can go out of the fridge for a snack. You don't have to pay $20 for a packet of chips and a can of Coke. So there you go. You can have as many. Oh, you can't have as many people as you want over, but you can certainly have, you know, your mates over, and you're in the comfort of your own living room. So there's certainly plenty of items in the pro column.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think that whole thing about the novelty of waking up is something that we've had to embrace. The thing that, you know, it's, I feel like for some games, you're really excited before you go to bed that you actually can't sleep. And then when you actually wake up, you feel like you're still awake. You feel like you barely slept. It only hits you at about 1 p.m. that day. And you're like, oh my God, I'm stuffed. I'm completely, absolutely naked. So I think like some of those games, you think of like those World Cups where you know your team's playing at like 4:30 and you're like, oh, I can't wake up. Getting 6 hours sleep. But you can't. There's the anticipation because you know that at 11 o'clock, there's another game. It's like 11 o'clock p.m. You're like, oh, but there's someone else playing, but my team's playing. It's like you literally have to plan this meticulously. Like you have to think, okay, how can I get enough sleep so I make sure my next day I'm not a complete write-off the next day? But then realize that the next night you're going to do it all over again. Like during the World Cup in 2018, my God, like every night it was a plan. Like, oh, you know, there's Russia, Saudi Arabia this night, but the next day Portugal playing Spain. But beforehand, you've got Egypt playing Uruguay, and I want to watch Mo Salah play, and I want to watch Uruguay play. And you've got to plan and plan and plan. What games can I watch the next morning in a mini match? What games do I want to watch live? I reckon for me, that's the ritual of it. Like, I think that's the beauty. And he's checking the fixtures, you know, when we get to summer. I love the 6:45 a.m. kickoff because you wake up, it's sunny, the sun's out, and you get enough sleep, you're able to get up and watch the game straight away. Early 9:30 p.m. kickoffs to get to the Premier League and stuff like that. That is the beauty of it. So being able to plan in around that, I really don't mind it.
Well, I find it a lot easier waking up for games, especially when it means something. So like, you know, as a West Ham supporter, we're in a relegation fight at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
So you want to watch the game. And you know what? I mean, I don't like being in a relegation fight, but you know, you low-key do because it's exciting. There are games to play. The matches mean something.
Every game, like, I tell you season. What, every between us, the amount of relegation battles we've seen, Wigan and West Ham supporters here, you know, Championship relegation, Premier League relegation, it is the most unbelievable run because every game, as you said, is a six-pointer. And there's always that, like that game where it's like you're playing a team that also are in the same boat and it gets to that point where it's 0-0 and it's half an hour to go and you're like, all right, we're going to go for it. And it's that excitement. I absolutely agree with you because that season when Wigan were last in the Prem, we had the FA Cup run, but we also had the relegation battle. So every game was like, oh my God, we're going for a trophy. But at the same time, we've got to save our skins. Like every game is just amazing. So, you know, in terms of that, Athos, I think that's a really good point. I'd take a relegation battle over a title run. Or Champions League battle versus the relegation battle. Like, when I base how I get...
You definitely take a relegation battle over just finishing 10th and...
Or finishing 4th or Europa League. But yeah. I think title, yeah, you take the title. But like,
take the title.
For me, like when I compare, when I've been getting up to watch Milan battling for 4th compared to getting up to watch Wigan in a relegation battle, I take the relegation battle because you know that if you don't finish 4th, not the end of the world. Like, you're still going to be there next year. Just play Europa League. But if you get relegated, kaput. That's it.
Certainly. Well, this is at home with FNR. We're just having a good old chat about our experience watching on the TV. We will have to get used to that, given that we can't go to games anymore. Be sure to send in your favourite memories watching games on TV, either on the Facebook Live or on the SMS 0428 933 45. Nick, we'll take a break. And when we come back, there is plenty going on in Europe. You mentioned Milan. They're in a proper fight for 4th at the moment, as are several sides. In Spain, the title may have just been decided this morning. Plenty more still to come. At Home with FNR coming back very soon.
You're listening to At Home with FNR.
Welcome back at home with FNR. It's Athos and Nick. We're just over 1 p.m., but we did start a bit late, so we will continue and power through this next little bit. We've got Josh Parrish joining us because we're about to talk Europe. There were some pretty big results overnight. In Italy, Juventus just flexed their muscle. All their big guns scored some massive goals. We're talking Douglas Costa, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Paulo Dybala all scored goal of the season contenders. They got a massive win over Genoa, just making things that little bit tougher for Lazio, who are, you know, still on their tail to pinch the Scudetto off them, but they will have to get past the quite a stubborn old lady to do so. And over in Spain, it was one of the more anticipated matches of the season. Barca's last real chance of a title tilt, but they were held to a 2-2 draw against Atletico Madrid, who are pretty much locked in for the Champions League as well. But Josh, that's two draws in a row for Barcelona. And a lot of people are starting to perhaps have a crack at a few of their players, namely Antoine Griezmann.
Well, you couldn't really blame Griezmann for this morning's performance, given he only played for 5 minutes. But I think the question does have to be asked, why did he only play for 5 minutes? Why is he being continually left on the bench? And the reason, which was said rather bluntly by Quique Setién after the game, he said it's tough to bring Griezmann on without destabilising the team. Which was a very, very telling remark, I think. And, you know, I think that Barcelona have kind of made the same mistake twice in a row. Coutinho didn't fit because he was sort of too similar to Messi and kept occupying similar positions. And the problem is even worse with Griezmann as a left footer. You know, Griezmann's done his best work as a sort of second striker in a front two, but he can kind of occupy two positions, either just behind a striker centrally or maybe coming inside off an advanced position on the right onto his left boot. And those are the exact two zones occupied by Leo Messi. So they can't get all of their best players on the park without having serious tactical issues in their way. There's lots of other problems throughout the team, but Sid Lowe in his Guardian report today referred to them as a dysfunctional and decadent football team, and I think that's pretty accurate because they've got too many aging superstars and not enough players who can pick up the defensive slack, and Gerard Piqué in particular was exposed over and over again.
It's an interesting one, Josh, because you look at their lineup this morning and as you said, it does look a bit unstable. Like, you know, I know Fotmob's nothing to really, you know, look at, but you see Arturo Vidal shoved into a random position on the wing, and you said that it's almost like he didn't actually have a position out there. He was just there.
It was very odd.
Yeah, and you feel like, you know, with Antoine Griezmann and with these players they keep signing, I'm just wondering, do you think it's a case of Barcelona doing a bit of just signing them because they can and because they just want to almost keep them from their rivals? Or do you think that they actually think they can transform a player like Griezmann to play a different role alongside Messi? Because at the end of the day, if you're being signed and you're a guy like Ousmane Dembele, Philippe Coutinho, or in this case, Antoine Griezmann, you've got to find a way to work around Messi. Messi's not going to step aside. But as you said, Gerard Piqué, Sergio Busquets, maybe they've got to start looking for something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think I still have hope for Dembele. He's had a lot of injury problems and he's obviously, I think he's got some probably maturity issues as well. He's very young and very raw still. I remember him being late for training and getting fined because he was up all night playing video games and things. So he's kind of a kid in an adult body, Dembele, sometimes. I think he is the right kind of player for them. They need somebody who can play on the left to complement Messi and not be always coming short for the ball, but running in behind, taking on defenders, using pace. And, you know, Neymar maybe doesn't play that way anymore, but he used to be the perfect accompaniment as a flying attacking winger cutting in from the left and getting onto all of those through balls from Messi and scoring loads of goals. That was the perfect formula with Suarez as the predator up front. But they haven't been able to strike that balance again since Neymar's departure. They've reinvested the money very, very poorly in Coutinho, in obviously Dembele, and now Griezmann. That's, you know, upwards of nearly, I think, 300 million euros wasted on players who haven't panned out or don't fit the system. There's serious problems at just a technical level in terms of the sporting department at Barcelona, who's in charge of these signings, because it doesn't seem as if the manager has enough authority to make them. And I think it's a weird situation where Messi politically has almost become bigger than the club and bigger than the coach. And potentially, you know, there are stories coming out about the senior players at Barcelona, namely Piqué, Busquets and Messi, just not really respecting Quique Setién and doing their own thing. And, you know, if they never believed him in the first place, then, you know, why did the club choose to hire this guy?
And everything that's you've touched on, it's totally against what this generation of Barcelona players stood for. Every time they brought a player in, he was there to fill a particular role, and he made an impact straight away. Barcelona were almost laughing at Real Madrid and these kind of clubs who would just bring in players for the sake of it, and they wouldn't do anything. And now the shoes on the well and truly on the opposite foot. Barcelona are doing that. They've put in three, you know, superstar players who haven't fit the system. And, you know, if there are political issues, then that's a bit of a concern, because expectations are very high. And, you know, if they don't get some wins on the board and if Madrid don't drop points, then the white side of La Liga is going to be rewarded with another trophy.
Well, I think that Real Madrid now are really going to have to capitulate, and they're looking very, very neat at the moment. Like, they've got Getafe in 2 days' time. I don't like, as much as Getafe have a fifth and have continually, the second season, are really batted above their average. This is a chance for them to, this probably really would be the only game that I could see them maybe dropping some points. They've got Athletic Bilbao after that, and then they still have to play Villarreal. But it's going to take a lot. I just don't think, because I think Barcelona dropping too many points on their own accord, even if Real Madrid were to lose, you know, Barcelona aren't necessarily playing well. They're not winning games. And Real Madrid, I think, rightfully deserve to win the title this season based on their consistency in the last little period and rebounding from the break sensationally. You know, you see how well Karim Benzema is playing at the moment and the guys in around it. This team are looking like they're finally back to, you know, that La Liga form that we've seen a lot more. You know, we've seen them dominate the Champions League for so many years, but now they're going to, they're finally going to get themselves that title that's sort of eluded them the last few seasons.
And you'd probably say Benzema has been the best player in this side. The unsung hero for many, many years, playing as the accompaniment to Ronaldo and kind of sacrificing his own goal-scoring potential in order to make space and drag defenders out of the way for Ronaldo to score. I think he was a really underrated part of that Madrid side that won so many Champions League titles with Zidane. And he's finally got that spotlight on him, and he's finally getting the chance to shine. And, you know, he's always been this good. It's just no one noticed.
And it hasn't helped that he's been more or less banished from the French national team as well.
Yeah,
but
different reasons.
Yeah.
That assist that he gave the other day, I don't think there are words invented yet which can describe how good it was. For those of you who haven't seen it, it was a back heel nutmeg, and it resulted in the winning goal for their most recent win against Espanyol, who unfortunately are going down themselves. So he's been on top of his game for the last, you know, 10 years nearly, Benzema. So great to see that he's getting the rewards.
I think let's quickly shift focus. Just quickly, Athos, you did mention the Serie A title race.
Yes.
And you did mention how tight it is. And I cut out of the call for a couple of seconds and I missed the conclusion of that. But you saw how Juventus and Lazio both won this morning. Incredibly enough, as much as it feels, I don't know about you guys, it's only 4 points, but there's 9 games to go. But the way Juventus are playing at the moment, whether they're playing well or not playing necessarily well, they still find a way to get results. And this morning, typical Juventus, 3 cracking goals, the attacking football that we haven't seen much of, finally a bit of fluidity up front, and Douglas Costa's goal, oh my goodness, chefs, it's beautiful stuff. But Lazio, interestingly enough, now face a bit of a dilemma. Now, they play the rampaging AC Milan at the moment, who do play Spal tomorrow morning, and Rich is rampaging Milan, so they've only won 2 games in a row. But Lazio will miss their front two players, Ciro Immobile and Felipe Caicedo, will both miss with suspension. Now, that's going to be interesting. A big hole up front for Lazio. And I think if they go further than 4 points behind, or really further than, you know, that amount, I think that's curtains. Title will go to Lazio, to Juventus. And based off what we've seen from AC Milan in the past few games, is they're looking a lot better at the back. They're taking their chances up front. And that's potentially a danger game without that marquee man up front.
Look, we all knew Juve is going to win because they either play well and score goals or they get given a penalty. Like, honestly, some of their decisions that have gone their way recently have been ridiculous. It's almost like Serie A is structured to just deliver them the Scudetto year after year, and it's getting a little bit boring. I think Serie A has been absolutely brilliant this season, but there's just this sense of inevitability that Juve is going to win the title. So it never... you know, really excites when it feels like a foregone conclusion, regardless of how good Lazio have been. I mean, I want to know what's happened to Antonio Conte's Inter, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we were absolutely talking them up for the title, given how disciplined they were, how they were grinding out results and looking very fearsome, as Conte's sides often do. But they've dropped off the pace.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Just quickly, we spoke off air yesterday about it, about physical and mental fatigue playing in the Conte system. You know, I remember in the preseason hearing that they were training ridiculous amounts in the searing American summer, like in ridiculous 40-degree temperatures. He'd be demanding, you know, seriously physical sessions, a lot of running, a lot of fitness work. And his system requires, you know, players covering immense ground and working their socks off. Now, the thing is, I think that they don't rotate much. They're starting to rotate now, and their depth is starting to get worked out a little bit because a lot of these guys haven't played much. They're not necessarily playing well. A lot of the guys like Alexis Sanchez, Diego Godin and Alexis Sanchez, I reckon, have pooped in themselves because they've been playing that much football for the past 4 or 5 years in continental tournaments for Chile and Uruguay, respectively. And also guys like Ashley Young, Victor Moses. They're playing guys like Borja Valero, Matias Ficino. I just don't think that they're inter level. They're going to have to look at maybe looking to try and rejuvenate the squad again in some areas, especially in their depth, because they have a great starting 11, and bringing in Hakimi is a very, very good signing. But again, when the whips start cracking, you know, can they get the job done if players go down? Because when players start to go down, that's where they'll get exposed. If they want to keep playing a 3-4-1-2, they've got to keep Lautaro Martinez, because I don't think Alexis Sanchez is going to cut it.
Martinez is surely going to Barcelona. You know,
that's the thing. If Martinez goes, who are they going to pick up? That's the worry, you know, with that, even with all that money, strikers of that premium, of that sort of football who works so well with Romelu Lukaku, where are you going to get that?
Well, thankfully for Inter, their draw is actually quite favourable to see at the season. I think over the next month or so, the best team they play is Hellas Verona. So I think that just says what their next 4 or 5 game looks like. If you're a Juventus fan, though, I wouldn't be celebrating too hard just yet. They still have to play Atalanta, at the moment are one of the uniform sides in Serie A, and then a mouth-watering clash against Lazio. I think both those games are at home, so Juventus will be favoured. But talk about two marquee fixtures to see off the season for Juventus. They will certainly earn the title if they get over the line.
Well, Luis Muriel. What about Luis Muriel's goals against Udinese earlier this week? That was just ridiculous. Two absolute belters.
Just Atalanta, far out.
They
are a Ferrari.
The best, most entertaining team in Europe. The title has been passed from Napoli a couple of years ago. It's now Atalanta who are the appointment viewing.
Well, Napoli play almost anti-football to what they used to know in Napoli. They play such defensive football that they are completely away from their norms. So Atalanta, I tell you what, they are the greatest story in world football right now for what they've been able to do with that sort of football, with that sort of budget and the players they've picked up, a lot of money ball signings, a lot of guys that, you know, they're not going to get any marquee names. Guys like Mario Pasalic, who wasn't playing with Chelsea, constant loan spells. Alejandro Gomez, who's been there for so long. Luis Muriel, Duvan Zapata, Martin Darude, Ruslan Malinovsky, the list goes on and on. And that squad is just so well oiled. Like, the thing is about them, they concede a lot. Like, their defense is a bit of an issue, but they will score 5 goals. So it's like, well, we'll take 2 goals back the other way. But they trust that their attack will come through every single time. And I remember when Milan played them in December and they lost 5-0. They should have lost 10-0. Like, that was literally a pasting. And the thing is, when people say that, you know, they're a chance to win the Champions League, you've got to take that seriously. They can beat anybody, no doubt about it, because how can you counter that attack? An attack is ridiculous because they will find a way to score every single time. And it's really, really exciting. Guys, I've got to run in a second, but I just want to give one last quick little tidbit before I go. A little shout out to a team that I think haven't been getting too much plaudits, but they've been in some remarkable form at the moment. I think the guys in the FNR group chat are sick of my screenshots after every single game they play and all the constant stats. But if you've been keeping up to date in the championship, a team known as Wigan Athletic, have now gone almost five months without conceding a goal. And that has been a big break in between. But they're the only team since, I believe, mid-Feb in the English football hierarchy who have not conceded a goal. That's seven games without a goal, nine games unbeaten. And for being inside the relegation zone, they're now 8 points clear and 11 points away from sixth. I'm not saying they're going to get promoted, but all I'm saying is keep an eye on the mighty Ticks because they're coming.
They certainly are, and I think we'll end it on that positive and incredibly optimistic note. Thank you so much for joining us. If you missed any of the show so far or missed our chat with James Coughlin from the Brisbane Football Review, head over to the FNR Spotify or SoundCloud. We'll be back on Friday for the go-home edition of the week of At Home with FNR. From Athos, Josh and Nick, it is goodbye for now. Have a great week in football.
You're listening to At Home with FNR.